the pharmaceutical space, your job is to make molecules that make people better. You happen to need buildings to do that.
Right.
But it's always a massive distraction. And so it tends to be those big clients are going, if there was a better way to build things, I would spend more of my time doing the big value adding stuff. I would spend less time on construction. You know, it's those sort of things with a bigger social purpose or higher purpose that happen to need buildings.
Hello, innovators. I'm Todd Wyant, and welcome to the Bridging the Gap podcast presented by Applied Software Great Tech Group. You're invited to join our conversation to model the future of construction innovation and the digital transformation adventure of this great industry. We recorded this conversation live from the Advancing Prefabrication Show in Denver, Colorado. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. We are here live at Advancing Prefab, sitting with Jamie. Thanks so much for coming down and taking the time to talk with us.
No, thanks for the invite. Glad to be here.
Awesome. Well, kind of, if you don't mind, give a little bit about your prefab journey and what led you to Advancing Prefab.
So as a company, we started out on this journey sort of 29 years ago now. So we were dissatisfied, let's say, with the way the construction industry worked. So we started out as a team of architects. Martin Wood, one of the co-founders, said he wanted to be an architect, but not in an industry like this. And the sort of, I think, disconnect between designers and construction, we were sort of perceiving this thing that lots of designers aren't that close to the construction thing. So we've really lent into that and started to look at how we could design things in a way that would influence construction. That became design for manufacture and assembly, and we've sort of continued to work on that journey for 29 years. So when we started, that was quite a niche thing to do, and obviously now it's becoming vitally urgent that we do this.
Right. What do you think has been some of the big drivers behind the kind of scale up of prefab?
It's always, our experience has been, it's the big clients who need buildings, but to serve a greater purpose. So in the pharmaceutical space, your job is to make molecules that make people better. You happen to need buildings to do that.
Right.
But it's always a massive distraction. And so it tends to be those big clients are going, if there was a better way to build things, I would spend more of my time doing the big value adding stuff. I would spend less time on construction. You know, it's those sort of things with a bigger social purpose or higher purpose that happen to need buildings. It's those big clients has been the real driver from us. When it works, it's because a client is invested and wants to get on and do things.
Yeah. How have you noticed the difference between EMEA and then the North American side with when it comes to prefab and trends?
So my personal view, I think a lot of the thinking has been done in Europe, but I think it'll happen at scale here. The conditions you've got in this market, obviously you've got these big serial clients in the sort of particularly data center space. There's something more entrepreneurial about the sort of spirit of people here. So what we're seeing is the big manufacturers trying to move up the value chain and get close to clients. The big clients reaching down because they have to talk to their supply chain.
Yeah.
The GCs in the middle kind of saying, if I don't have a better value proposition, you know, what am I doing? And so that condition where people are genuinely trying to find better ways of working, I think that's quite exciting. The scale at which you're doing it, the kind of size of the market. And I think probably having watched some of the things that have happened in Europe, obviously, when you're a sort of fast follower, you get to not make some of the mistakes that maybe we have made in the UK and Europe, and start to go, right, now I know what to do. I can move much faster in the right direction. So I think all of those things are coming together to you know, that's why it's happening at pace over here, I think.
Yeah, interesting. How do you think the technology aspect of it is helping to kind of influence and drive the prefab movement?
So I think there's a growing linkage of the kind of physical and digital worlds. And I think that's probably because everyone's seen it happening in, you know, adjacent sort of sectors and things. But I think now, yeah, that process where you used to, you know, use CAD to develop a drawing to then go through a load of manual processes to give to a, you know, person in the field. I think the speed with which we're now getting much more into linking the digital to the physical, closing some of those gaps. And the idea that, you know, seen it a bit this week, linking the kind of digital models straight into robotic fabrication, automation. We're just compressing that gap now, which we have to do. So that's kind of speeding the process up. It's making it much more certain, and it's allowing all these new technologies and new use cases to start to get deployed.
Yeah, nice. Well, let's dive into your presentation this morning. So you got to be up on the stage and talk about the partnership with TerraPraxis. I'd love to hear more about that and kind of what was the genesis of that partnership?
So we've been doing a lot of stuff. I've been working with the UK government for probably 10, 12 years now, initially on sort of BIM and digitalization. Then that sort of got into design for manufacturing assembly. Mm-hmm. Through that work, I actually got introduced to Kirsty Gogan, who's one of the co-founders of TerraPraxis.
Okay.
So she had seen the work we were doing with kind of central government on sort of kits of parts approaches, and said, actually, where that would be really helpful is in this emerging space of small modular reactors, advanced mm-hmm. heat sources. So they need to scale up dramatically, and a load of the techniques that you've developed for other sectors actually would be really valuable.
Yeah.
So when we first met them, we didn't know anything about this world. Once we started realizing that, you know, within those sorts of projects, you've got the advanced heat source, which is a kind of manufactured sort of element. There's all this stuff that surrounds it, which is the kind of more normal construction. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you combine the stuff that we're doing in that space with the stuff that the SMR manufacturers are doing, that starts to make it very scalable. And then they mm-hmm. came up with this concept. So TerraPraxis as a company are looking at all sorts of aspects of this, of how we decarbonize energy, how we make energy much more sort of globally available. They came up with this concept that if you could take the coal-fired power station fleet and literally swap out the heat source, so turn off the coal-fired bit, replace it with an mm-hmm. advanced heat source, everything else, the kind of the turbines, the generation, the downstream grid stays the same, but you've replaced a thing which is one of the biggest carbon emitters with a thing that's not.
Right.
And you go, the simplicity of it, the sort of beautiful simplicity of going, we could tackle a massive, you know, chunk of the carbon emissions by that one kind of simple concept.
Yeah.
That we thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
And the scale of it, the opportunity for scale and things, it plays really nicely into this sort of industrialized construction agenda.
Yeah. I love the simplicity aspect of it, because, you know, oftentimes with innovation, it's really a simple concept that has the biggest impact. What were some of the unique challenges, though, that you guys faced in trying to bring this to life?
So I think the TerraPraxis are so well known, I think, in this space, and so well regarded in this space. I thought it was really interesting that they could talk to all of the different manufacturers of the different SMRs, advanced heat sources, and bring them all together. Mm-hmm. So whereas you would have expected there to be competition, I think the size of the prize is so big, the kind of the social outcome of what we're trying to achieve is so obviously necessary.
Yeah.
They were able to convene this incredible group of the kind of manufacturers, the regulators, academics, people like ourselves. They kind of pulled together this consortium of loads of different experts who understood different parts of the mm-hmm. complexity of this, brought them together and said, how do we collectively solve this problem? And I thought that's been really interesting, you know, meeting people who understand about regulation and, you know, how you go through that, meeting the academics, meeting the people who understand how to market this. So that's been mm-hmm. really interesting. We love that sort of process of getting a very holistic, very collaborative team to solve what's yeah. clearly like one of the biggest challenges on the planet at the moment.
Right, right. Was there an education component that you guys had to go through to get people ramped up and up to speed on what you guys were doing, or how was that? Was that pretty?
Yeah, we didn't understand quite how far the technology had changed in the last, it's happening at enormous pace. Mm. So we had to spend quite a bit of time just familiarizing ourselves with what the technologies are capable of, you know, what they look like, how they work. Obviously, you know, all the kind of, a lot of the concerns that people have had around nuclear in the past aren't sort of relevant anymore. The kind of new technologies are designed to fail safe. You know, they're much more passive in the way that they operate. They use, you know, tiny amounts of fuel and things. So our mental picture of what some of the technology was capable of was completely wrong and outdated. And if you look at things like the kind of, you know, traditional big nuclear power plants, massive, mm-hmm. huge investment, you know, take decades, it's not like that anymore. The kind of pace of change of technology, that was really interesting
yeah.
to kind of learn about, you know, what's been happening in the you know, last couple of decades of this.
Yeah, interesting. Where do you see it going over the next couple of years with that, you know, ramping up of scale of pace?
So we're seeing, I mean, I talked about this a bit in my talk. This is a really common thing that we're seeing now. There's loads of these new technologies around carbon capture, advanced heat sources, decarbonization of pharmaceuticals, you know, changes in data centers. So the stuff I was talking about this morning is that as a sort of general concept, there's loads of these new technologies that have to happen really quickly and have to happen at massive scale. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a new challenge. Like, you know, they're not building one or two of these things. You have to do like thousands of deployments. So that for us is a big theme at the moment, where we're having to try and develop the sort of tools and techniques, digitization, design automation, mm-hmm. kits of parts manufacturing for a range of different technologies, all of which have to happen really quickly. Mm-hmm. And you sort of can't compete with maybe some of the traditional supply chains who are already maxed out doing data centers and healthcare and all the other kind of social infrastructure. So that mm-hmm. thing of needing brand new capacity for brand new technologies at a pace that no one's ever done before, that is fascinating to us, but obviously presents massive challenges, but huge opportunities.
Yeah. So how do you go about trying to overcome that challenge and create something that hasn't been done before at a scale and pace that hasn't been done before?
So to some extent, I would sort of characterize it as the last 25 years of Bryden Woods' journey has been, we didn't know it, but it was like a practice for this.
Nah.
So all the things that we've learned in the past around how to engage clients, how to build these kind of holistic collaborative teams, how to put some rationality into design things so you can start to really focus on which bits are known, which bits are unknown, how to use that to drive design automation, creating kits of parts and things. We were obviously doing it based on the sectors we knew about. Turns out that range of skills is incredibly useful. So we're definitely not saying we have all of the skills, but we know how to convene these sorts of teams, and we can draw from lots of experience that we've already kind of learned in the data center, pharmaceutical, healthcare, other worlds. So that's been quite exciting for us. We didn't know that's why we were doing it, but it turns out that the skill set, the capability we've been developing over 25 years is well positioned to help now tackle not just one or two, but you know, a broad range of these new approaches, new technologies.
Yeah, very cool. Let's kind of broaden out to sustainability from a higher level. So for a long time, you know, it's a huge kind of buzzword and topic of conversation. People knew that we had to do something about sustainability initiatives and decarbonization, but for a long time, it seemed like it was, a lot of theoreticalness and kind of aspirational. How is it becoming more practical now?
So I think there's a number of things over the last, certainly 5-10 years. I think it's become so obvious that the gaps between what the industry can do mm-hmm. and what it needs to be able to do is massive. So all the things around skills gap and aging demographic are all mm-hmm. kind of mixed into this. I think it's become so obvious that we can't possibly deliver on the things we need to do. That's become really sort of apparent to people now. Mm-hmm. I think certainly in the UK and Europe, I would say the sustainability conversation has been going on for a lot longer.
Yeah, you guys were ahead of the curve from where we were here.
Maybe, but I think there's one thing I think is quite interesting is I talked about this idea of all these things are connected. Mm. So there's a number of levers, whether it's productivity or sustainability or cost. When you pull one, the others kind of come with it. So we were focused on productivity for a long time. If you're increasing productivity, you're almost certainly using less material, less people mm-hmm. working. But then you go, oh, turns out that will also have an impact. Or if you focused on carbon, you would do the same thing. So one thing that I think is quite interesting is that you get this sort of a whole load of things that are all pointing in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And sustainability turns out to be the one that's now being talked about, but it's telling you the same things as, you know, mm-hmm. sort of productivity and things. I think the fact that the big clients now have to have have recognized that they have to have a view on this mm-hmm. and the lenders are starting to say, we're going to put things in place. People are starting to make it much more tangible, the outcomes of not having a story around this, and that's incentivizing people to get into it. So I think that's starting to put it in the front of people's minds. It's the usual thing, as soon as it starts to become a commercial imperative, people start to take it more seriously. It's a bit sad that's true, but I think that's one of the things now.
The reality,
that's driving it.
Yeah.
But again, I think it's really, we talk in the office about happy coincidences, so it's a really positive coincidence that all the things you would do to solve the skills gap and productivity and things, you're also tackling sustainability and carbon and all those things.
Right, there's good alignment there. Yeah.
The industry is struggling with a communication problem and a lack of interoperability. This is causing 25% of data being recreated and almost $300 billion loss due to bad communication. Great Tech Group believes that is a problem. So they created Data Connect, an easy-to-use, no-code platform that connects critical ERP systems with cost management to form a single source of truth to empower better communication, decision-making, and project efficiency, delivering the ultimate business outcome of being on time and on budget. Visit asti.com/dataconnect to start saving time and money.
Well, what were some of the kind of takeaways from your talk this morning?
I think one of the things that we love being here because you can, it's very collegiate, the sort of atmosphere here. Mm-hmm. So I was talking to someone yesterday and saying it's more like a movement. You're in the room and there's a whole load of people who are all trying different versions of this, but they're all kind of heading in the same direction. So I think there's something really exciting about being here, that people are sharing their failures as much as their successes. They're all kind of leaning on each other. They're all trying to, you know, move everyone forward, not just their own company. So I think that is one of the big things that I'm quite interested in. So I use this phrase, yes, and, that Bolt talk about.
Yeah.
So there's a real sort of celebration here. People going, yeah, do that, and this thing, and here's another one. And, you know, the idea that you get exposed to lots of different things people are trying in the same space, sort of sharing with each other, and you kind of realize there's loads of these things going on, all heading in the same direction. That's been quite interesting. So I talked a bit about that, this idea of being in the room. And I think that, yeah, one of the key things for me was this idea that because of the scale of the social challenges, so population growth, population movement, climate crisis and things, I was saying, you know, what we do in the next 25 years will set the course of the rest of humanity. So if you want to be a bit high-minded about it, you know, what we're doing in the room is we're saving the planet, we're saving the people on it. That's the purpose of the movement of advancing prefab, which sounds a bit
no pressure.
Maybe sounds a bit high-minded, but I really think that's true. I think, you know, the stuff that we're doing at this conference, the things that people are doing here to transform construction, we really have to do it, because if we don't, we can't possibly build enough stuff for the next 4 billion people are coming. We really will destroy the environment before we get, you know, before the next 4 billion people have arrived, which would be a terrible legacy.
Yeah. What conversations do you think will be happening at Advancing Prefab in 2030?
I really hope we'll be looking back on, reflecting on the last 5 years and going, wow, that was the fastest pace of change in the industry that anyone's ever witnessed. And hopefully at that point, it will be sort of moving exponentially, that we'll be excited about the next generation of technologies and the next generation of power, carbon capture type things. If in 5 years we're having the same conversations that we're having today, right, we've lost, I think.
Right.
So yeah, we have to be looking forward to the next 5 years and saying, yeah, we'll have made some dramatic inroads into, you know, the transformation that everyone knows that we need to have in the industry.
When it comes to some of the emerging technologies, are there certain pieces of tech that you have your eye on, of like, let's look into this a little closer?
I couldn't call it. One of the things that a colleague of mine used the analogy of when COVID started, they didn't just say to Pfizer, can you create a vaccine? They said to everyone, all of you, go. Like everyone, you know, everyone needs to be looking at this space. And yeah, someone will get there first, there'll be other things, but at least we'll have a range of these. So I think there's so many of these technologies happening at the moment. You go, and they all need to, you know, get going. Some of them will fail, some of them will succeed, but I couldn't tell you which ones are which. But I quite like the idea that, you know, no one's back. You have to back every single horse at the moment. We have to try absolutely everything we can. And I think that's quite interesting, that people aren't just saying, well, we'll just look at this one technology and hopefully that will sort the problem. They're saying, we'll look at, you know, lots of different types of carbon capture, lots of different advanced heat sources, loads of different things in hydrogen, batteries, storage, pharmaceuticals, all of those things are all happening at once. And you go, it's quite dizzying, the array of things, but thankfully there are this, you know, loads of things that are happening in this space.
Yeah. What would your advice be to designers or contractors that are trying to stay ahead of the curve with this kind of rapidly changing and evolving industry?
We're really trying to encourage, with some of the apps and things we do, we try and open source everything we do. We don't patent things. We try and put stuff out in there. I think there's sometimes a reluctance for designers to engage with this stuff, because I think there's a concern. It came up as a question today, that will design automation remove the need for architects? And I was saying, no, there's so much stuff to go at. Like, that's not the problem. The problem is if we don't do some of this automation, we haven't got the bandwidth to keep up. So
right.
I would encourage designers to really engage with this stuff, embrace this stuff, not see some of the things around standardization and kits of parts and things are happening as a threat, but to kind of really lean into it and say, well, how do I pivot to being more of a kind of a product designer? How do I start to think about configuration? How do I start to use repeatability to do more design and better design? So in no other industry does anyone think that, you know, automation manufacturing results in better in worse design. Mm-hmm. So no one looks at cars and phones and white goods and goes, oh, it's not very, you know, right. No one's really thought about that one, have they? So right. Every other industry uses that to do more and better design, continual improvement, refinement, and get better and better solutions. Mm-hmm. And I think we're stuck in this cycle in traditional construction where we start from scratch every time you go, we haven't got the time to do that.
Mm.
And there's this massive opportunity to do more and better by leaning into it. So I'd encourage anyone who isn't already thinking in this way to start really understanding what's available, you know, build on the stuff that's available and start to, you know, move the conversation forward.
Yeah. How do you address the maybe naysayers that say, yeah, you can do that in manufacturing. It's a clean environment. It's the same controlled environment where construction, there's so much complexities here. We can't keep doing that.
So we've been trying to tackle it by, we have a team that does data analysis across projects. So when we've done things like, we did a housing configuration app for the Mayor of London, for London Housing, that was based on analysis of like thousands of apartments worth of data from all across London. And actually, so what we found was there's loads of sort of latent standardization.
Mm-hmm.
So because of, you know, building regulations, statutory approvals, space standards, client preferences, designers sort of tend to converge on quite similar solutions anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of floor to floor heights and distribution of space. So, but if we'd told designers that, that might have been unpopular. But if we say it's interesting, the data says,
right,
this is the DNA of London Housing. There is actually loads of latent standardization. If you just enhanced the commonality a bit, suddenly you get this explosion of kind of repeatability. And you can, but it doesn't do anything to diminish the architectural quality because it's kind of what you're designing anyway, but you mm-hmm. can spend more time on the, you know, the facades and the placemaking, all these things. So mm-hmm. we've tried to use objectivity and data to demonstrate where there is standardization that you can enhance and where there's not, and mm-hmm. you know, separate them out and say, these bits you really do need to spend time and effort doing the bespokeness, but actually there's loads of bits that actually you end up with fairly common solutions anyway.
Right.
And I think increasingly clients are saying, well, you know, I wanted a kind of repeatable thing. I know my market rate. I know what the market will withstand. I wanted to, you know, tend towards a, not quite a product, but something that's more kind of repeatable.
Mm-hmm.
Often bespokeness isn't increasing the value. You know, you do a load of bespoke mm-hmm. design, but it doesn't increase the value sufficiently that it's worth doing. So I think, again, it's clients driving this and saying, I don't want to invent these things from scratch every time. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather continually improve them and get better and better and, you know, standardize in that way. So
mm-hmm.
again, it's sort of clients driving this to say, look, this is what the market wants. That's right. Where we should be heading.
Yeah, there's an interesting human psyche element there, I think, of people don't want to be told what to do.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
as soon as you point out, like, hey, you guys are already doing this naturally anyway, it's easier to accept it. Like, oh, yeah, I'm in the driver's seat here and I'm leaning this. And so it's not forced upon me.
But there's another thing that I've said this a bunch of times in different forums. But in the early days of BIM, people talked about this sort of dream world where you'd be, you know, working in 3D, collaboratively mm-hmm. working, co-creating kind of things. And you go, there's Minecraft. So there's an entire generation who already, like, their heads are already there. They're already going, yeah, I use completely standard right. components in Minecraft. No one's ever said Minecraft has stopped any kid from doing something interesting and creative.
Right.
Or Lego is the other obvious example. You give, you know, two different five-year-olds the same bag of Lego, they'll make something completely different. So that we find really interesting. There's this generation, you know, my kids who are incredibly digitally literate. They already, you know, work creatively in a, you know, sort of digital environment.
Mm-hmm.
Our job is to get the industry ready for those guys to come.
Mm-hmm.
You're going, they already know how to do this, actually. Our job is to kind of get out the way. So again, this sort of mm-hmm. legacy thinking of you'll never change the world. You're going, no, it's already happened.
Right.
We just have to get ready. Or if we don't get ready, that generation won't enter construction. We'll have an even bigger problem because we already don't encourage enough young people in. So the idea that you could make it look more like a, someone said it on the stage today, you know, you make it look more like manufacturing and automotive and big tech, and that becomes more attractive to the next generation. If we don't, they'll all go and work for, you know, the tech companies, and that's the end of construction, because there'll be no one left to design these things in the first place. So
So bringing it back to advancing prefab, why is what's the power behind an event like this? Why does it have an impact for the industry?
I think it's the most, it's definitely the most collegiate conference. It's like a music festival. It's like Glastonbury or something. Like you're running around between the stages. There's loads of really interesting things to talk about. Some of the best presentations I've seen, one of the healthcare guys presented a couple of years ago, did this amazing presentation on the journey they'd been on, this playbook they'd put together, the standardization, and then said, we threw it in the bin because it was too complex. We hadn't engaged people. And here's what we then did, the simplified version. So some of the best talks I've seen are people saying what they did that didn't work. To kind of say to people, and don't make that mistake, here's what we learn. And that, I think, is really interesting, that people are, you know, sharing their failures as much as their successes, so that everyone else doesn't make the same mistakes again, so that everyone moves at a faster pace. That, I think, is quite, that's unusual. You go to a lot of conferences and people just want to show off the best thing they've done. And, you know, they don't really tell you the full story of how they got there.
Right.
This is the conference where people are saying, here's all the wrong steps we made before we made any sort of progress. And that's what that looks like. And that is incredibly refreshing. Obviously, it builds trust. And again, it's this sort of collegiate atmosphere of people aren't doing it to, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. People aren't trying to do it to do their competition out of work. They're doing it because the size of the prize is massive and we all need to be grown up about it and moving in the same direction. So that, I think, is the kind of unique flavor of this conference.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you can learn probably more from your failures than your successes, and to crowd share that, and that's where you get the scalability of it.
Yeah, it's if someone just shows you a really good thing, it's hard to replicate it. But if someone says, here's the journey we went on, and here's all the missteps we took, then it becomes much easier for people to go, I can now see the path of how we could do that and how we could transform and how we can move in the same direction. So yeah, it's much more valuable, I think, to be sharing those sorts of stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we start to land the plane here on the conversation, a couple of rapid fire questions for you. What is the phrase modeling the future? What does that look like to you?
Modeling the future. I suspect we're getting to a point now where the amount of data that we have at our fingertips and the tools we have to kind of parse that data and do things with it, I think we're getting closer and closer to being able to do the sort of big simulation we'd need to really look at some of these things. I don't want to fall into the trap of talking about AI. I think we're actually quite a way off that making as big an impact maybe as people think, but I think there's certainly a lot of the things that we can do now around the sort of decarbonization projects and things like that. I think there's much better data sources. We did a carbon capture project with someone, and there's an incredible data set of all the carbon emitters in the US. And so you can really start to match the kind of market with the technology now in a way that you couldn't do. And it's like an open source data source that you go, oh, brilliant. I can suddenly do loads of market analysis in a way that I couldn't before. So those things, I think, are going to happen a lot quicker.
Yeah, nice. What does innovation mean to you?
The way we think about it, I think, the way I think about it, there's this sort of, imagine a kind of landscape, and you can't see over the next hill, but you have to sort of climb this hill, and then you sort of course correct and go, ah, we're actually heading over there.
Yeah.
I think we try and do that a little bit. So we have, you can't sort of stem that. You need a level of creativity or invention to solve some of these things. So sometimes we'll propose an idea that we don't think is the right answer, so no one knows the perfect answer straight away. Everyone knows a bad idea when they see one. So we deliberately try and put things out there, fail fast, and people go, that'll never work. You go, okay, why not? Why not? And you learn something by doing that. So innovation in our heads is sort of making a series of potentially wild steps, but every step on the journey tells you something, and then you can course correct. And then, that sort of fail fast, try things, elicit feedback from people. I think that's the way we try and work.
Yeah. Like it. How do people find out more information on what you have going on in the partnership with TerraPraxis and connect with you?
So if you look on brydonwood.com, There's tons of resources on there. There's loads of publications you can download. There's the open source apps you can get links to. You'll find stuff around repowering coal, the TerraPraxis thing. So yeah, the website is there's a huge portal of resources that people can download and try things. You can look on some of the apps, you can play with some of the apps yourself, you can have a go at some of these things and start to experience what the technology feels like.
Awesome. Well, final question for you. If I could give you all construction power and you could snap your fingers and innovate one thing, what would you pick to innovate?
What would I pick to innovate? I think simplifying things, I think, is one of the key things we've tried to do. So, if you could suddenly, the whole platform thing was based around, could you do what IKEA has done for construction? Mm-hmm. I would try and do something like that and say, actually, can we really simplify these things down to, you know, repeatable components, repeatable processes? How do we turn construction into IKEA? Because it's that kind of order of magnitude. So something like that, I think.
Yeah, very interesting. Jamie, thanks so much for taking the time. And
no, thanks for talking with us. It's been interesting and fun.
Bridging the Gap is hosted, directed, and produced by Todd Wyant. Edited and produced by Eric Daniel. Bridging the Gap is an Applied Software Great Tech Group production. Copyright Applied Software Great Tech Group 2024.